We are dealing with tonight one of the great theologians of the church, a man named Gregory of Nyssa. I'm being a little facetious when I say that he looks like a party. He looks like the kind of party I would want to go to, which isn't saying much about parties.
Mary and I had Irene had an uncle that looked like that.
This is the third of the Cappadocian Fathers. It's been a couple months since we did one of these. But if you'll remember, we've been studying a handful of men back in the 300s who collectively are known as the Cappadocian Fathers, three great church fathers from this little area of what's now modern Turkey that was called Cappadocia. On the back there you can see there's a picture of a particularly interesting landscape in Cappadocia. It's sort of a dry, dusty place, but they have interesting rocks there. Hermit cells carved into the rocks. Down below, you get a picture of all three of them together. Basil, Gregory of Nazianzus, and Gregory of Nyssa. Someone was telling me that I should try to find a robe like that to wear in worship. I don't know where they got those. But Gregory of Nyssa is the third of three guys, so he's going to wrap up our mini-study on these Cappadocian fathers. And then next time we'll probably move on to someone a little bit more contemporary. But just to set the scene a little bit again, if you don't remember, back in the 300s, Christianity was in an interesting situation all around. Politically, religiously, theologically, it was a very potent time in the life and the history of the church. Up until the year 310, they had been a persecuted minority within the Roman Empire. The Roman emperors would come out and they would, every so often, they would set decrees out there saying that Christians were to be purged in some cases. Often that would mean that your neighbors would grab you and drag you down to the local temple of the cult of the emperor, and you would be expected to make a sacrifice to the divine emperor. If you didn't, they knew for sure that you were a Christian, and you could be thrown in jail, or you could have your possessions taken away, or you could be killed. There are a number of executions that took place during that period of history. But around 310, the scenario changed. One of the emperors, by the name of Constantine, decided to become a Christian. And when Constantine became a Christian, Christianity suddenly became the cool new thing to do. All of the royal court became Christians. Most of the leading senatorial families in Rome and in Constantinople became Christians. All of a sudden, they had these massive freedoms, they had massive wealth that was given to them as churches. And so one of the problems they faced in Gregory's day and age was that a lot of people were jumping on the bandwagon who weren't really Christians in the deepest sense. They were doing it because it was the thing to do. But Gregory and his brothers would sort of fondly look back and say, oh, for the days when we were persecuted, because then at least we knew who the real Christians were. So that's one of the things going on. The other thing going on was that in this new environment, a whole bunch of other sects and denominations and cults jumped out of the mix. And the most prominent of these, other than the Orthodox, which is the historical term for true Christianity is called Orthodox, and that would include every denomination that we have here in town, with the exception of, say, the Mormons and the Jehovah's Witnesses. Episcopals are Orthodox Christians, Catholics are Orthodox Christians, Baptists are Orthodox Christians, meaning that we agree on the basic fundamentals of the faith, who God is, who Jesus is, and those core issues of what makes us Christian. There was a group that popped up called the Arians, who did not agree with the Orthodox on the question of who Jesus is. They thought that he was divine. They would call him the Son of God. But they thought that he was a creation of the Father, that he was below the Father himself. So in some ways, it's very similar to what you would find in Jehovah's Witnesses today. Gregory and his brother and his friend Gregory of Nazianzus were the three main leaders who took up this fight after the great forerunner Athanasius passed from the scene. So to set the scene, in the 300s, there was a council in 325 that gave a great victory to the Orthodox faith. And from that council, we have what is called the Nicene Creed. If you've ever worshipped in a Catholic church or Episcopal or some other denominations, they would say this fairly regularly in worship. It comes from that setting. But even after that church council, the Arians stuck around and they kept fighting. And they actually started to win a lot of people over in the middle of the 300s, including some of the emperors, some of the royal court. And to the point where it looked like they were going to win completely. And the true Christian church was just aghast at this. And so this guy, Gregory of Nyssa, and his friends were the ones who stepped into the void and turned the tide. Let's begin by looking at our verses, because of course all of these themes that we talk about here are biblically rooted. So the first one is from 2 Corinthians chapter 3. This is the Apostle Paul writing to his church of Corinth, and he's speaking here about his ministry and the ministry that he hopes, the experience of God that he hopes they will join with him in. He says, "We, who with unveiled faces all reflect the Lord's glory, are being transformed into his likeness with ever-increasing glory, which comes from the Lord, who is the Spirit." There are two ideas here that Gregory of Nyssa is going to jump off of from this verse and create a fairly broad base for the theology that we now practice. One of them is the idea of human nature, and he uses the analogy of human nature as mirrors, that we were made to be a mirror of the image of God, which seems to be what Paul is suggesting here, that we reflect God's glory back to him. And we'll come back to that idea in a little bit. The other one is that the Christian journey is a constantly upward journey. That it's not just a matter of getting saved, and once you're saved, you're in. Get that ticket punched to heaven, and it's just smooth sailing. Of course, there's some truth to that, but the way I'm putting it should suggest to you that if that's what you're holding on to, you're missing a big part of the picture. Being saved is the beginning of a great and glorious journey throughout this lifetime and into eternity, in which we will grow to understand more and experience more and more and more of God, and to grow ever upward and ever onward into that relationship with Him, that it never ends. The other verse I've chosen here is from Exodus chapter 33. This is a scene similar to the one I read about from Elijah, where Moses is up on the mountain and Moses wants to see the glory of God. So Exodus 33:18-20. "Then Moses said, 'Now, show me your glory.' And the Lord said, 'I will cause all my goodness to pass in front of you, and I will proclaim my name, the Lord, in your presence. But,' he said, 'you cannot see my face, for no one may see me and live.'" And then, of course, the end of that story is that Moses gets hidden in the cleft of the rock and covered over by God's hand for a while, so that as the Lord passes by, Moses is only able to see God from the back. The idea being that the presence, the actual presence of God, would be so glorious and so great that no human being could withstand it, could withstand the grandeur of who God really is. What we'll see in Gregory's work is that he takes this story and many stories from the life of Moses and uses them to talk about our relationship with God. So that's going to be the primary theme tonight. It has some great applications for our lives as Christians here and now. When we ask ourselves, what does it mean to know God more? What kind of journey is that? What does it feel like? And while we might want to think that it's sort of this continual experience of greater and greater bliss and joy and triumph, what we actually see in the life of Moses and in the testimony of Scripture and in the experience of church history is that no matter how much you know of God, there's always more that cannot ever really be known, because God is that big. And because God can never really be known, the deeper we know Him, the more, in a sense, we are walking into veils of unknowing, of silence. And sometimes the deepest Christian experiences we can have are experiences of doubt and of silence and of difficult and dry times in the Christian life. That sounds counterintuitive, but over and over and over in the history of Christian experience, you see this popping up again and again and again among those who know God best. So we'll come back to that in a few minutes. Let's look at the story of Gregory himself. Look at the first note there by his picture. Gregory of Nyssa was one of the three great Cappadocian fathers, along with his older brother Basil and their mutual friend Gregory of Nazianzus. Though overshadowed by the other two during his own lifetime, modern theologians now see him as the most original theologian of the three. He was a defender of the doctrine of the Trinity at a crucial period in church history. The reason why the other two overshadowed him a little bit, and if you remember anything from their stories that I gave you a couple months ago, Basil was really a bit of a firebrand. He was a go-getter. He went out and he planted monasteries. He started new church movements that the church had never seen before. He went and he challenged the emperor toe-to-toe and stared him down. Gregory of Nazianzus was a little bit more laid back, but he too sort of ended up in the limelight. He became the Patriarch of Constantinople, which is one of the biggest jobs in the Christian church at that time. Gregory of Nyssa was much more of a shy and retiring sort. He was never the bishop of a huge city, of a great patriarchal see. He was a quiet, studious man, so he didn't capture the attention there. But now, and especially within the past 50 years, theologians and historians have been going back to his work and seeing that his influence runs far, far deeper than the other two actually did, especially in areas of theology and practice. For instance, some of the philosophical ideas that he taught the Christian church about God are still ways that we think about God today. They do come from the Bible, but like most of these theological issues we've been talking about in this series, they're ideas that you sort of have to piece together from 100 different verses in the Bible, and Gregory is one of the first to piece those together for us. So we owe a little debt of gratitude to Gregory for some of those philosophical ideas that all of us hold, but we may not know exactly how we got them or where they came from. He also had a profound influence on the mystical tradition. Mystical is simply a word for the experience of God, the theology of experiencing God. And he gave us a pattern and a framework for understanding the Christian journey that got picked up on over and over again throughout Christian history and has proven fairly accurate for many of the greatest Christians of history. So we'll describe that a little bit more fully when we come to his ideas. Let me read the second note there. Gregory was not active in church leadership until Basil thrust him forward to be the bishop of the small town of Nyssa, but he did not prove to be good at church administration. His contribution to the Christian tradition comes by way of his theological ideas and his writing. He framed the classical idea of the infinity of God and laid the groundwork for every subsequent theology of the Christian life. His most prominent work today is the allegorical study, The Life of Moses. Basically what he does in that book, which I would recommend as a good book to read, it's fairly accessible. He takes the story of the life of Moses from Exodus and Numbers, and he interprets it as a view of the Christian life. So you go through the stages of Moses' journey, and then use those experiences of Moses to think about, well, what does it mean for me as a Christian to leave behind the land of my slavery? To be brought through the waters of baptism, to be tried and tested in difficult circumstances, to learn to trust God for my nourishment. All these things that Moses and the people of Israel went through, he writes this brilliant study on and applies it to our lives today. I don't have his story written out here in timeline form as I did with the others, because his much of his life is not quite as full of daring do as his brother Basil's was. So I'll just give you a quick rundown of his story before we tackle his ideas. Gregory was about 5 years younger than his older brother Basil. Basil, of course, was the outgoing, extroverted, firebrand one. Basil was able to study in Constantinople and Athens, the best universities in the world. Gregory was not. He stuck around his hometown. He attended basically what we would call sort of the local community college. But he was naturally brilliant, absolutely brilliant. And so he did a lot of study on his own. And the fact that he didn't go and study at the greatest universities of his time probably allowed him some of that freedom of thought that helped him develop these ideas that have paid off for Christian thinkers for almost 2,000 years now. So he stuck around home a little more, and his family, it was absolutely phenomenal. I mean, not only his brother Basil, but he was one of 10 children, 5 of whom are now honored as saints in the Catholic and Orthodox churches. If you know anything about that kind of tradition, to be anywhere closely connected to even one saint is a big deal. To have 5 of them in your family is ridiculous. This was a family of powerful faith. They had grandparents who had been martyrs under the persecution. They had grandparents who had had to run away and live in the woods for 7 years in the persecution, and who had taught them these lessons. They had an older sister, Macrina, whom we know almost nothing about, but both Basil and Gregory both say in their writings, look, if you guys think that we are spiritual and holy people, look at our sister. And she had a tremendous influence on both of their lives. Interestingly, Gregory himself wasn't all that interested in religion when he was growing up. He was kind of a wishy-washy guy. So if you have young people in your life that strike you as that kind of thing, don't give up hope yet, because God may get a hold of them and use them for something extraordinary. He didn't really have much interest in it. But he was sort of cajoled into going along to church services with his mom, and he went. But he didn't put anything into it. He sat in the pew like so many people do, and sort of kept time as to when he got to go again. But after one of these church services, on a particular holy day of the church calendar, he received a dream that terrified him. That God, he felt, was reproaching him for not taking this seriously. And so in a frenzy, he goes down to the church and he signs up on one of the volunteer sign-up sheets, you know, just like we do, to be a church lector, which means you help in the readings. So you get up there in the pulpit during part of the service and you read the scripture passage for that day. And he did that for a while, but eventually his fervency waned, like it does for all of us, really. And he got bored with it again, and he stopped doing it. He decided to go and become a professor of rhetoric. He was a bright guy. He could do this. So he went, and he taught at the local college. And most of the kids who came in there were kids of local gentry who were hoping to go off and join the army. They really weren't interested in philosophy or in literature, which is what Gregory was trying to teach him. And again, he sort of got discouraged with that. He thought, well, none of these kids care at all about what I'm trying to teach them, so we gave that up too. So you start to get to see a little bit of this guy. One of the things these studies encourage me most about is the people that God chooses to do tremendous things through. Often they're really not that outstanding in terms of their natural qualities of character. What makes them outstanding is what God does through them. And Gregory's the same way. He was the kind of guy who starts things in a frenzy of activity and then gets half-hearted and gives them up and goes on to the next thing. Well, eventually, after he left teaching, his sister Macrina got a hold of him and convinced him that he needed to get himself right with God. And so he went and he lived in one of his brother Basil's monasteries. Basil had started this new ministry, planting monasteries around the country, and Gregory thought, you know what, that sounds good to me. I'm a guy who likes to sit alone and read, so I'll go do that for a while. So he did. He went and joined the monastery. He studied, he learned theology, he started writing. And that's where he stayed for a while. All during this time, Basil is doing his heroic stand against Emperor Valens, who is an Arian heretic, facing down this heresy that's threatening the entire church. And eventually, Basil, who knows his brother is brilliant, calls on him and really elbows him into taking a position of church leadership. Gregory has no interest in this. He doesn't want to be a leader. He has never wanted to be a leader. He doesn't have great people skills. But his brother is forceful enough that he lets himself be bullied into it. And so Gregory becomes the bishop, the church leader, in a tiny little town called Nyssa. And some of Basil's friends came up to him at this time and said, "Well, look, Basil, your brother is a really, really good theologian. You could have given him a better spot than that." I mean, imagine if it were here in Maine, and Basil is sort of overseeing all the churches in Maine. He could give him Portland, he could give him Bangor, he could give him Lewiston. Instead, he gives him Michalis, or Medibemps, or Bering, you know, something like that. I love all these places, by the way. And the people come up to him and say, "Well, why are you doing this? He's your brother, and he's brilliant. He could have any of those bigger cities." And Basil said, "You know what? You're right. Gregory is good enough as a theologian to oversee the entire church gathered into one. But," he said, I want the town, I want that church to become famous because of the man leading it, rather than the man becoming famous because of the name of the town." So he says, "You know what, I could give him Portland." But then everyone would just say, "Oh, Bishop of Portland, that's impressive." Instead, what happens is that students of Christian history know the name of this obscure town, Nyssa, which really was a nowhere town. And we're still talking about it 2,000 years later because of this guy. I think Basil, in a way, sort of had mercy on his brother. He knew this wasn't his brother's dream job, but he also knew that Gregory wouldn't want the prominence of the big town. So he gives him the little town life. Unfortunately, Gregory really isn't all that well suited for it. He's a good pastor. He's a good teacher. He loves his people. But when it comes to church administration, church finance, all the logistical things, he's not good at it. He's not good at it at all. And in fact, the Arian opponents, the heretics, pounce on this. They know he's Basil's brother, so they go after him. And they actually drag him down to the court on charges of embezzlement, that he has been stealing church funds. And poor Gregory is just sort of hapless and bewildered. He knows he doesn't do a good job of this, but he also knows that he hasn't been stealing from his parish. But the political situation is such that he really can't defend himself. And he ends up being banished. During this time, the emperor banishes a number of Orthodox church leaders, so they have to leave the country completely. And they stay out there for a few years until the emperor Valens passes away. He dies in a battle. The next emperor is more favorable to true Christianity, and so they are called back. And this is one of the highlights of Gregory's story, is that as he's coming back, even though he really didn't do a great job running this town, the inhabitants of Nyssa so love this guy that they walk out. As soon as they hear he's coming back, they walk out and meet him at the halfway point. So imagine that, you know, I was out there banished to Portland, and I could come back, and I was walking back, and the whole town meets me at Bangor and walks the rest of the way back with me. Not that that would ever happen to me, but it did happen to Gregory, and they just loved him. It was this wonderful, triumphal return, and a powerful moment in Gregory's life. A few years later than that, Basil dies, leaving Gregory really as one of the leading figures of Orthodoxy. He's known through the books he's written. He's known because he's Basil's brother. But now he sort of has to step up and be that public figure that he didn't want to be. And so he gets called to go to church conferences. And He doesn't like it, but he does a good job at it. In fact, his one crowning achievement is that he gets to go to the Council of Constantinople, where Arianism receives its crippling blow. And the council reaffirms the Nicene Creed, the great Orthodox creed of the church. And Gregory himself is given the privilege of writing and tweaking and honing the clauses of that creed into its final form. So the creed that we now speak, well, not we Baptists, but if we did, the creed that we now speak as the Nicene Creed comes from Gregory's pen, and was one of the crowning achievements of his life. But he was living in a season where the church was facing its difficulties, and they really struck at his soul. He was sent down to the church in Babylon, modern-day Iraq, to help the people out there, and he was disheartened by what he saw. There were heresies everywhere. Churches were fighting amongst each other. He went to the Holy Land and he hoped that it would be this great pilgrimage. And he saw the same thing there. Christians bickering, Christians living half-hearted lives. So, we see some of these things in our world today. The truth is, we are not necessarily at one of the dark low points of church history. These things have always happened. And what's remarkable to me is the way that God has led his church through all of those things and continues to do so. So he lives on until 395, continues writing, continues being one of the most important theologians of the church. I'm going to lead us through some of these theological themes now. Some of them are a little technical, but I'll do the best I can to explain what's going on here. The first is the Trinity. And I won't really go into that. We've talked about the doctrine of the Trinity when we dealt with the other two Cappadocian fathers. Gregory did have his own original contribution, which became accepted as part of the Orthodox doctrine. But I'll let you read that on your own. The next one, the infinity of God, is really where he put some of those pieces together from Scripture. And we still hold to that vision that he gave us back in the 300s, that God is infinite. Infinite in space, infinite in time, infinite in character. The reason why this was such an important contribution is because this is not what the philosophy of the day believed. The Greco-Roman world was very, very proud of its heritage of philosophy, of deep thinking about the way things are. People like Plato, Aristotle, Socrates, on the Roman side, Seneca, Cicero, great names. And they were very proud of them. But one of the things that school of philosophy believed in was that to be beautiful, something had to be limited. It had to be neither too big nor too little. It existed in what was known as the golden mean, sort of just the right size. This is what was beautiful to them. And so they believe this about God too, that God essentially was a limited being. And because he was a limited being, of course, more powerful than we are, of course, more wise than we are, but because he is a limited being, you had the prospect of knowing God. You could understand him. You could come to learn who he is. And Christian philosophers early on, particularly a man named Origen, accepted this Greek and Roman philosophy in, because they thought that to be beautiful, to be understandable, to be accessible, God had to be limited. And they thought that he couldn't be infinite. The reason why, I mean, it seems natural to us. Of course God is infinite. We've been taught that from the Bible all our lives. The reason why it seems strange to them to say that is because the idea of infinity really is an incomprehensible idea. Mathematically speaking, we humans cannot get our minds around what that means for something to be infinite. For instance, if we're talking about a relationship with God and an infinite God, that means that no matter how much of God you know, there is always an infinite amount of God yet to be discovered. Yet you can't sort of track your progress and say, okay, you know, I think I've walked with God long enough so that I sort of have about, yeah, you know, maybe I've experienced about half of all that He is. Well, no, you can't have that, because half of infinity is infinity. You can't break infinity into halves, because it just doesn't work that way. It's also a confusing idea when you think of infinity and time. What does it mean for someone to exist before there was time? Even the word I'm using, before, is a time word. But we just don't have concepts for that. If you think about God being infinite in space, that means He permeates the entire natural universe and beyond the universe. Well, what's beyond the universe? Is there space beyond there? We don't know, but God is infinite through space. Does that mean that there is more of God in the fellowship hall than in the pastor's office, because there's more space in the fellowship hall? Well, no. But you see what a confusing idea infinity is. And the philosophers of that day did not like this idea, because it was messy. They didn't like messy things. It wasn't beautiful or orderly to them. But Gregory set us straight. He looked at the Bible and he saw it clearly taught God is infinite. And particularly he pointed out His goodness. God's goodness is infinite. And since goodness is the character of God, God Himself must be infinite. But then, and this is Gregory's real contribution, he took it a step further and said, because God is infinite, the goal of getting to know God never ends. It can't ever end, because He is continually bigger than we can ever comprehend or experience. There is always more of God to be known out there. And again, this is against the philosophy of His day. He really took a stand for Christian philosophy as being different from the philosophy of the Greco-Roman world. Because Greco-Roman philosophy thought that stasis was beautiful. Your goal was to achieve a perfection, a level that you could just sit at, and you've arrived. And Gregory says, no, in the Christian life, there is no such level. It is a continuous upward journey. Perfection in humanity means growth and change. So if you are not growing in your Christian life, that means that something is wrong. It doesn't mean that you've reached it. You're at the pinnacle. It means that something's gotten stopped somewhere. You should be growing. I've explained that note fairly well, so I don't think we need to read through that, but that's there for you to refer to. Let me read the note on human nature. Gregory used the biblical language of humans as the image of God. However, because of sin, we have lost our likeness to that image. So Gregory compares humans to mirrors. We were made to reflect God, but because of our nature as mirrors, we will reflect whatever we are looking at, good or evil. Thus, humans must use their free will to turn themselves away from evil and toward good, so that they can reflect the likeness of God again. This is a continuous process. I like this vision of humanity, because I think it's true, and it's something we don't often think about, that the way we are designed, Gregory argues, is as reflective beings. And of course, what we are made to reflect is God Himself. But because we're made that way, we are going to reflect whatever it is that we are looking at. And so it is not okay for Christians to go out in the world and allow themselves little sins here, little sins there, because the way we're wired, it's going to become part of our nature. It's going to become who we are. What we need to do as Christians is take away those things and turn to the things that are right and true and good, the virtues, so that we start reflecting those things, because that's what we were made to do, to grow into those things. The final theological theme I'll touch on here is the spiritual life. And I'm going to run a few minutes over, I'll tell you that right now. So if you need to leave, don't be offended. I really want to touch on this. Gregory was the first to offer a systematic foundation for understanding the spiritual journey as a continual upward adventure into the knowledge of God. However, for Gregory, this is a journey into darkness. We must lay down the pride of our intellect and seek God with the understanding that He is too great to be ever fully known. There are three stages of this journey: a darkness of ignorance, a spiritual illumination, and then another darkness, which is the experience of God as He is, beyond every capacity of ours to understand. This is difficult stuff to talk about and think about, because it's not the terminology we Baptists usually use. But you find it all the way through the mystical literature of the Christian church, that to get to know God at the ultimate level means, in a certain sense, giving up the ability to know God. Sometimes it means accepting long periods of silence and dryness in our spiritual life. Sometimes it even means wrestling with doubts. Many of us are taught to believe that doubt is a bad thing. But many times, for the greatest saints of the Christian tradition, silence and doubt and dryness are what they get sort of at that upper level when they are finally learning to be unattached from their senses and their perceptions, so that they can experience God as He is. Because we are so tuned into our sensory information, and that sensory information in no way can encompass the God of the universe, the idea is that we have to be trained off of that. And it takes a long time, and it's really hard. But that eventually, if we walk through that difficult journey, we may, even in this lifetime, come to a place to experience the God of creation in a whole new way. I can't say I understand it, because I haven't got there yet. But I think this is a challenging idea, and an idea that should encourage us to keep going. You know, no matter how long you've been a Christian, there is always more of God to know. And no matter what stage you feel like you're at, maybe you are in a period of great dryness in your spiritual life, where you feel like you're just talking to a brick wall when you're praying. What saints like Gregory tell us is, that's okay. In a sense, that's natural, and it might even be really good. It might be something that God is using to train you to experience an even greater revelation of who He is in your life. So don't give up when you're in those dry places of the journey. I do have a few quotes down here. I won't read all of them since we're out of time, but they reflect these themes that I've been talking about the God who is beyond our understanding, about human nature as mirrors who reflect whatever we look at. I want to read the quotes in the middle. So the fourth quote down, if you can count there, it's the short one just above the picture of the three guys there. He says, "The true sight of God consists in this, that the one who looks up to God never ceases in that desire." In another quote that I couldn't fit on here, he takes this idea and uses the analogy of food and drink. That we humans are wired with certain desires. We have a desire for food, we have a desire for drink. But then when we eat something, when we drink something, that desire is satisfied. The desire goes away. So let me use my example of Doritos, right? I like Doritos. I at certain times I desire to eat them. And that's a nice feeling, to desire something and then to have it. To feel that desire being satisfied. But then after you eat enough of them, you're like, wow, this is not so great anymore. I no longer desire these things. What Gregory's saying here is that the pursuit of God is the best of both worlds. We desire God, we go to Him, we find that fulfillment of satisfaction that is that great feeling you get. But it never ends. You can never get to the point where you say, "Whoa, I've had too much God for a while. I need to set that down." No, the desire, if anything, it just grows and grows and grows. The more you get of God, the more you want. And the wonderful thing is, there's always more of Him to be had. That's the vision that Gregory gives us of the Christian life. I'm going to leave you with this last quote, because it is tremendously encouraging one. I've said this before, sometimes many of our problems in the spiritual life are that we think too little of ourselves in terms of how God sees us. So this is the picture directly, or this is the quote directly by the picture of the three fathers there. God did not make the heavens in his image, nor the moon, the sun, the beauty of the stars, nor anything else which you can see in the created universe. You alone are made in the likeness of that nature which surpasses all understanding. You alone are a similitude of eternal beauty, a receptacle of happiness, an image of the true light. And if you look up to him, you will become what he is, imitating him who shines within you, whose glory is reflected in your purity. Nothing in all creation can equal your grandeur. I think that is a marvelously high view of what we can be as the people of God. So I will leave you on that encouraging note. Thank you all for coming and listening to this study. And go in peace.
Pastor, you're good. Yes. The whole time you were